Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up in our Week in Review, a House resolution condemning hate and anti-Semitism reveals deep divisions within the Democratic Party.
It's not always easy, and it can be messy and emotional to talk about, but I'm glad that we are trying to address this.
Also, on International Women's Day, the U.S. women's soccer team is suing the sport's National Federation, alleging gender discrimination.
To be paid equally, you know, it's not about what they think it's fair. It's what is fair.
And Unexampled Courage tells the story of how a black soldier, blinded on his way home from battle, changed the face of civil rights in America forever.
It was just something about that story of the soldier in uniform, battlefield decorated, blinded. What an act of injustice and lack of appreciation for the service to this nation.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's time for our Week in Review, beginning with a resolution condemning hate that finally passed in the House after considerable wrangling. It was a response to comments by Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar that some consider anti-Semitic. Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Although I don't believe it was intended in any anti-Semitic way, but the fact is that that's how it was interpreted. We have to remove all doubt.
Omar's remarks drew sharp criticism, including from Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
And it's unconscionable for any member of the United States Congress, even less a member of the House Foreign Relations Committee, to repeatedly traffic in base stereotypes.
The episode once again revealed divisions within the Democratic Party along racial, religious, and generational lines. Massachusetts freshman Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, for example, helped push party leaders toward broader language in the resolution, saying, quote, "We should have equity in our outrage." Joining me now to discuss is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at New Roots AMA Church in Dorchester. Hello, Reverend.
Good to be here. Happy International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day to you as well. And also with us is Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. How fitting. And welcome back to Radio Boston,
Thank
Jennifer.
Thank you very much.
All right. So Representative Omar has been accused of anti-Semitism for some of her previous comments as well. You know, she's apologized for previous tweets that said things like Israel has hypnotized the world or that politicians' support for Israel is, quote, all about the Benjamins, as in money. And this all flared up again recently when she made remarks at a panel discussion in D.C.
I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country.
She went on to compare the lobbying power of Israel to the NRA or the fossil fuel industry. Reverend Mariama, what's your takeaway from this whole saga, both the remarks themselves and the way the resolution was evolving, bungled, and finally passed yesterday?
Yeah, so I think, I guess there are three things I think about. So first of all, I think the conversation around Israel is a challenging and nuanced conversation. And whenever you try to have a nuanced conversation in a soundbite way, that's a challenge. That's an issue. You're gonna end up in this territory. What I think is difficult for me about that actually has become the norm of the day. And so I think if we want to have a conversation about that, if we want to say that it's not fair to reduce things to soundbites, I completely agree. And then I also agree we should have a broad conversation about that. So to hear Mitch McConnell say that we shouldn't have Congress people who traffic in base stereotypes while supporting a president that has routinely trafficked in base stereotypes feels very hard for me to take seriously. So if we want to have a nuanced conversation about Israel and about anti-Semitism, then let's do that. There is a deep challenge because it is the only country in the world that has a ethno-religious citizenship. So that makes for some complexity about how do you separate how you feel about a particular group of people and how you feel about the country. If the country, if there's a mix of those two, and that's the only place, for instance, being born there doesn't inherently make you, you know, Israeli. So I think, but that's again a kind of nuance and complexity that doesn't fit in sound bites. And I think we should have that conversation. I think it's been challenging because we've ended up in a stereotype back and forth from people who I have not seen play deep leadership on this issue.
But Jennifer Braceras,
I think conversations about Israel are complex. I agree with that. Yeah. And I think the way you raise it does show nuance in your understanding of the debate. However, I don't want to have a nuanced conversation about Representative Omar. I want to have a very blunt conversation about her. She is an anti-Semite. Her comments were deliberate. Her comments were provocative, intentionally provocative. She has used old tropes and stereotypes about Jews controlling the banking industry, about Jews controlling the media, about Jews controlling the foreign policy apparatus of this country. These are tropes and stereotypes that go back not just in this country, but go back to pre-World War II Germany and well before that.
So you don't buy Nancy Pelosi's argument that, you know, as an immigrant who didn't grow up here, she may not be as familiar with the history or the significance of what she was saying.
Oh, she knew exactly what she was doing. She knows exactly, and she will continue to do exactly what she has been doing, because she is an anti-Semite and she is an unabashed anti-Semite. And I do understand that it's upsetting for some people to see condemnation of this new young woman of color representative by people who aren't willing to also stand up against hate in other circumstances. And to that, I would say we need to stand up to hate in all circumstances, and we need to take each situation as it comes. And so a global condemnation of hate is basically as good as nothing. I mean, we're all against hate in the abstract. That's easy. It's easy to pass a resolution saying we're against hate. The question is, do you know it when you see it? And are you willing to call it out when it's in your own house, meaning your own body, the House of Representatives, and in particular in your own party? And that is what the Republicans did with Representative Steve King. They called him out. They punished him. And that is what the Democrats in the House leadership need to do with Representative Omar.
Although, as Mary Emma pointed out earlier, they haven't always passed like a resolution like this every time the president says something that people are offended by.
I mean, as far as I know, this is the first time I've ever heard of a resolution being passed.
Well, so what?
It doesn't have to be a resolution. Take her off the Foreign Affairs Committee. Censure her. Do something. She is an anti-Semite. She is deliberately provocative. She is on the committee that makes decisions about our relationship with Israel, and she's made it clear that she is not interested in a nuanced conversation about Israel. She has made it clear that she is against Israel and against our relationship with Israel, and she needs to be off that committee, and she needs to be dealt with by the leadership of her party.
But I guess my question for Democrats, though, is to what extent do you do what, Jennifer, you're saying you should do, which is just handle your own business, you know, handle your own house first, versus doing what Miriam, you did rightly and point out, well, here's what Steve King has said, or here's what Donald Trump has said. I mean, do you play that sort of, well, what about game? Because there is some merit to that, and there are degrees. So, you know what I mean? Do you stand on principle, or do you play politics?
I think one of the challenges here is I've heard people say that stuff about Muslims, and there's not been any conversation about any introduction of anything. Now, I'm not Muslim or Jewish, but as a person who sits in between, I have not seen consistency. And so
I agree.
If we want to go there and we want to be about that, then let's do that. Let's do it consistently.
But we can't have whataboutism. We have to deal with each situation as it presents itself. And this is the situation presenting itself now.
And I hear you. It actually, though, strengthens the argument of people who say this when we only do it in one context. Because it then says only one kind of hate speech is problematic, and all the other ones, well, you shouldn't do them, but there will be no consequences. And so I think that doing it that way actually strengthens the argument that only one group has the power to get that kind of censure.
Well, look, I, for example, saw Liz Cheney on the news today, representative from Wisconsin. She spoke out very strongly against Steve King. She has spoken out very strongly against the president when he has said things that have been insensitive at best. And she spoke out very strongly today against Representative Omar. Now, I can't speak for every single member of the Republican caucus, but there are certainly many consistent Republicans and Democrats on this issue. The problem is that in this particular case, we could not get a majority of the Democratic Party to condemn this particular person, and that is a very sad thing.
And I guess what I'm ultimately saying is I understand what you're saying about it being too broad. But what is hard for me, and I think, again, it actually strengthens the argument, is when there are only consequences in one case and not in others. If we're going to do it, let's be consistent. Let's be consistent in our fighting against all hate. And then I would say, if we say this is the first time, but every time after this, we are going to apply the same test, the same thing, then I'll be fine. But I'm not necessarily hearing people say, let's make a shift in how we handle these issues across the board. And if we're not going to be consistent in all forms of hate, then I'm not sure it actually moves the conversation to do it in just one case.
Well, that is the argument that we heard from Democrat Chuck Schumer, and he was talking about what McConnell had said yesterday, and he's making the point that Mariama is making just now, that Republicans need to handle their own business as well.
Why doesn't Senator McConnell talk about the people in the march in Sharpsville who marched on a synagogue and chanted, burn it down, and then Donald Trump said both sides are to blame?
So I guess, I mean, Jennifer, are Republicans trying to, they've been, for the 2 years that Donald Trump has been in office, routinely accused of bigotry. I mean, are Republicans perhaps reacting so strongly to Representative Omar because they want to try to put the shoe on the other foot for political reasons here, and they're not?
No. Absolutely not. I just gave the example of Representative Cheney, who's been completely consistent on all of these issues.
But a lot of Republicans have given tougher
decisions. She's a leader of the party. And look, the president has said some things that have been, like I said, insensitive at best. I have condemned them. Other people have condemned them. And now we are standing up and we are condemning the anti-Semitism of Representative Omar. It's not inconsistent on my part. It's not inconsistent on, I can't, we could sit here and go through every member of Congress and say whether they've been consistent or not. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're here to do. We're here to talk about Representative Omar and whether or not there should be sanctions for her. There were sanctions for Representative King, and rightfully so. He was an embarrassment to the Republican Party, and there's no place for people like that to hold leadership positions or chairmanships within the Republican Party, and the GOP made that very clear.
Go ahead, Mariama.
So, I think everybody should speak out. Where I'm having the question is, what are the consequences, and can we be consistent about the consequences? Because that's where I see an inconsistency. And I do see inconsistency with some people in terms of speaking out in general, right? For me, Charlottesville is also about anti-Semitism.
Of course. They were carrying Nazi flags.
Right. So I think, folks who backpedaled on that and then are so excited about this, you're like, if you're truly against anti-Semitism, I need you to be, even in that, consistent in your call.
You were talking about nuance before. I do think it'll sound crazy to say this, but in some ways, Charlottesville was a nuanced issue. It was not nuanced in terms of there were hateful people carrying swastikas who are obviously racist and anti-Semites and filled with hate, and they should be condemned, and there's no two sides of that issue. What was nuanced about it was the debate over whether or not Confederate statues should come down and be moved. And so I think that when some people heard the president say there are good people on both sides of the issue, some people thought he meant on the issue of statue removal. And there is. There are two sides of that issue. There are not two sides of the issue of the Nazi flag. There are not two sides of the issue of those particular marchers, those particular demonstrators. But things did get, I think, people say, well, if you weren't ready to come down on Charlottesville, then you're not willing to condemn hate. That's not necessarily true. You can condemn Charlottesville and still understand that there's a nuanced debate about statues and which ones to remove and when and why.
It does seem, though, that the degree to which you're willing to give someone the benefit of the doubt does depend, at least to some degree, on which party you come from. And we could spend our entire time together on this subject, but I do want to get to a couple of more. One is a big local story that was in our headlines this week, and that was UMass President Marty Meehan saying in his State of the University address on Monday that the university system plans to launch a new national online college specifically for adult education.
This is a way for the University of Massachusetts to be strategic, to make smart decisions that make sense, and it will add to the revenue of the university over the long run.
An online college, he says, is necessary to confront changes in demographics and a decrease in demand for higher ed. And Governor Charlie Baker says he's on board, too.
UMass as a system should be the adult online education leader here in the Commonwealth for people who are either looking to secure a credential because of their place of employment or to finish the degree that they never got finished.
But the question, of course, is can the university compete with already established online programs like Southern New Hampshire University? President Meehan says yes.
But the UMass brand is a good brand. It's a good brand regionally, but it's also a good brand nationally and internationally. So we think that we can grow our online program to scale, and we think, frankly, the UMass brand has a better likelihood of being attracted to students, adult learners all over the country.
All right, Jennifer Braceras, does this make sense to you? Has President Meehan swayed you that online education is the way to go for the UMass system?
Yes, I think he's right. I'm a former trustee of the university and a graduate of the UMass Amherst campus. And I have to say, a big fan of President Meehan and the job he's done at the university. I do think that online education is the wave of the future, but I think in particular what he was talking about is the financial need of the institution to diversify and to think strategically, because UMass is in an unusual position compared to other state universities. We are located in Massachusetts, which has all these other private institutions that they compete with in a way that the state university systems in the Midwest don't. And so we have that. And we also have a 5-campus system in a relatively small state. And so UMass needs to begin to think about other revenue models. But the university also needs to think about streamlining what it already has. And it needs to think about whether it can reasonably support 5 campuses, or even if it sticks with 5 campuses, whether it can streamline and avoid duplication of programming at the 5 campuses. And there are other ways that the university can cut back, and that would be one of them.
Well, and the number of campuses is one of the questions that was brought on by last year's $75 million acquisition of Mount Ida, right? So Mariama, I think one of the criticisms here would be that we're seeing kind of a scattershot approach. On the one hand, the system is saying we need to go online, but we also see them expanding brick and mortar. How do you see that?
So as a layperson, but also someone who lives pretty close to UMass Boston, I heard this and my gut reaction was, I hope this is true. I hope that it can bring in more money. And it felt like I wasn't sure. And again, I haven't done all the research and look at the economic modeling. It felt to me potential wishful thinking that it's going to fill the gap as I've understood how deep that gap is. So I do think it's good to be thinking into the future. But I have noticed the deep investment in more buildings and that's probably also to try to compete with the other local colleges. But I hope it will be successful. But I was concerned by a comment I read by someone at UNH that said they were not sure if they had made the investment now, if they would reap the same benefits, that what they have received was because they got in before anybody else was there and therefore were able to sort of gain a sizable market share.
That comment caught my eye, too.
Right. But I mean, Southern New Hampshire got in more than a decade ago.
Right.
And they've built a 93,000 enrollment. It's been a big
right.
success.
And so the question is,
at the same time, that comment was made by somebody who probably is petrified of UMass cutting into its market share.
Hmm.
Well, and I mean, I'm sure that, I mean, I take that with a grain of salt, but I do think, again, this question is, if you're going to do a new business model, what is going to be your competitive advantage over those other folks? And I'm not sure I'm clear yet what that.
Well, I think it's the UMass brand and the UMass, the academic brand. And I think, as President Meehan says, does carry a lot of weight in New England, around the country and around the world, and probably more so than Southern New Hampshire. Right. And so that's what he's banking on. And I wish him the best of luck with it. I would also like to see UMass streamline its programming on its five campuses and think about ways it can cut back in what it's currently offering that may not be financially sustainable.
And there will certainly be opportunities to acquire more brick and mortars if they want. We see other small colleges struggling as well. I do want to get to one other topic while I have both of you. And the last subject we wanted to get to in our week in review is one we came to earlier in the week as well. This is the death of Jassy Correa, the 23-year-old woman found dead after she was allegedly kidnapped on a night out to celebrate her birthday at a Boston nightclub. Listeners, of course, this is a sensitive topic that may not be appropriate for all ears, so please use your discretion. Correa's wake will be held later today. There was a vigil last night at the Teen Center in Dorchester, and family friend Isora Mendez was there and said it was hard because she has lost other loved ones to violence, too.
It's tough. It's tough because how are we going to explain this to a young people? For someone to go to a club on her birthday and just take her happiness away and take her away and just took her life, that's really, really tough.
Mariama, I know that part of the job of a pastor is to go to vigils like this. I'm sure it's one of the hardest parts of the job description. Yeah. How are you processing the news this week?
Well, this is my neighborhood. I live pretty close to the Teen Center. I know folks in the neighborhood who knew the family. And, you know, I think this is one of those points, and I don't try to tell people that life is fair because this is not fair. It's not right. And I think we need to think both from a community perspective, how do we protect each other, take care of each other? And then I think we need to think from a public safety perspective. Are there things we could be doing to make sure that this doesn't happen? This is the second young woman for this to have happened to. With the other one young woman, fortunately, they were able to find her before this is what happened. But
right.
There's a high likelihood it could have been. If 24 hours more had gone by, we might have had another fatality. And so I think it's a time to have a conversation as a community about. I remember when I was younger and going out with my friends, we had a code about how we sort of watched each other. You know, to be honest with you, it's just really heartbreaking, particularly for her child who will grow out without her mom.
Yeah, a two-year-old daughter.
And so I think our community also needs to think about how we're coming around that little girl to provide her the love and support that she needs, and to honor her mom's legacy in a way that it will never take away all the pain, but will allow her to live a life in which she knows that her mom was loved and that she is loved.
You know, when you talk about that code when you were going out and you talk about what do you do to stay safe, you know, we had this conversation earlier in the week with the Suffolk County District Attorney, Rachel Rollins, and she made an interesting counterpoint, which was that we should be talking not only about what do we tell our daughters about how to stay safe when they go out, but also make sure that we're talking to our sons as well.
Rather than asking questions about where Jassy was or where her friends were, we need to focus our attention on men who are overwhelmingly the ones that are making these horrible decisions and being violent against women. It's not a women's issue. It's a problem that men have to take responsibility for in their own lives, in their sons' lives, and in the social lives that they have with friends and colleagues.
So how about that, Jennifer Braceras? Is she right on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think bystander training is important for everybody. We really need to make people aware that when they see somebody, whether they're being harassed in a bar or they look uncomfortable or they're leaving alone or maybe look like they're leaving under duress, you know, if you see something, say something, stand up. We have to protect each other. That's, I mean, we have to do a better job of raising our children not only to be cautious and protective of themselves and their friends, but of the people they see around them. I heard Rachel's interview in full, and I know she talked a lot about going into the schools and doing education and educating boys to respect girls. And with all due respect, you know, somebody who's going to murder somebody or rape somebody isn't going to be changed by peer education in the fourth grade. I mean, this goes so much deeper. And the person who did this to Jassy is a monster. And I don't know that any amount of intervention in his youth would have changed the type of person he turned out to be. Now, I don't know, you know, family circumstances, I think, can play a big role, and, you know, role models and teachers. But sending someone into the schools to do an awareness program here and there isn't going to change an individual like this.
So I'd agree to some extent, but I also think we need to have a really deep conversation, because I actually think we would like to imagine that all of these are, you know, monstrous people. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't understand how people go into a spa and have sex with a woman that's clearly, this doesn't feel, I don't imagine all those people had to know that these women were not there consensually. So we've got some deep things, and they're deep in our society. They're not just a few guys here or there that are bad apples. So I do think we need to have a much deeper conversation.
Oh, no, there are a lot of bad apples. That's the problem.
And so the reason why I think we need to have that conversation is because something's wrong with our society if we're producing that many people that think this is okay. We need to have a deep conversation with ourselves.
I agree that there's a cultural problem. But part of that is, part of it's in the home. Part of it's the breakdown of the family. Part of it's mental health issues, drug and alcohol abuse. I mean, culturally, there is a lot that contributes to the violence that we've seen on the front pages of the newspaper. And all of those things need to be addressed. I mean, it's not a single pronged issue.
That's Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy at the Independent Women's Forum. Jennifer, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you.
And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Today is International Women's Day, and on this day, players on the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, all of them, including Massachusetts native Samantha Mewis, are suing the U.S. Soccer Federation. They say gender discrimination causes them to earn less than their counterparts on the men's national team, even though the women's team has the same responsibilities and is far more successful on the field. Their 2015 World Cup win remains the most watched soccer game of all time in the U.S., and they're the favorites to win the next World Cup, which is just a few months away. WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer is following the story and joins me now. Hey there, Shira.
Hey, Cal.
All right. So this is a new lawsuit that's been filed in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, but it's similar to a complaint we saw a few years ago filed with the EEOC. So what's the significance of escalating it to a federal lawsuit now?
Well, they want more results. I mean, they feel that the progress being made, by the U.S. Soccer Federation hasn't been fast enough. They haven't gotten quite what they wanted, and there's still the pay gap disparity that they're dealing with. They simply want more money. They want better accommodations, better match schedules, better travel accommodations. So there are a lot of issues that are still, as much progress as they sort of made with a new collective bargaining agreement, it didn't go far enough for the players, and there are still vast disparities. I think, you know, the phrase that was used in the complaint was institutionalized gender discrimination, and that's really what they're fighting for. And this is all part of a broader fight within women's sports. You see the WNBA players going after more, you know, pay equality or more pay. You see this happening also in women's hockey. So they want more. It's not enough, and they feel they're not being treated fairly for the caliber of team and the caliber of players that they are.
And they've been talking about this publicly, at least in the past. We haven't heard remarks since brand new lawsuit today, but back in 2016 when that EEOC complaint was filed, we had some of the players on 60 Minutes. This was Becky Sauerbrunn speaking with Nora O'Donnell.
When you compare this federation to all the other federations across the globe, they have invested the most money in this women's program. They have, and that's why we've gotten as far as we have. But to be paid equally, you know, it's not about what they think it's fair. It's what is fair.
So what you hear there, Shira, is the team giving the U.S. Soccer Federation, you know, some credit for progress. You mentioned the CBA they signed in 2017 that was a little bit better than the conditions in the past. But the U.S. Soccer response, and they haven't responded to the lawsuit, yes, but we know what their arguments are because we've seen it in the past. And they basically say, look, yeah, things are pretty good and they're better than they are in other countries. And by the way, if there is a pay gap, it's just because, you know,
FIFA gives out more money because the Men's World Cup makes more money.
And the ticket prices are higher.
The ticket prices are higher. Yes, all of that is true, but I think if you go through the complaint, which I have had an opportunity to do, you see just glaring disparities. I think one of the things that sticks out is this is one of the facts that the complaint cites. It says a 20-game winning top-tier women's national team player would earn 38% of the compensation a similarly situated men's national player would earn. I mean, that's a glaring difference.
In the best case scenario.
In the best case scenario, exactly. And to put that into real money terms, that's, you know, a best case scenario of $99,000 a year for a women's national team player versus $263,000 for a men's national team player.
So as we said, it is International Women's Day, and we did speak earlier today with Andrea Silbert. She's the president of the EOS Foundation in Boston, and she said she's looking for men to step up this year.
It is all about men. This is the year that we have to have men come forward and help us solve women's challenges.
So, Shira, in the moments we have left, how about that? Are we going to see the men's soccer players stand up here?
You don't need them to. Why? Because the women are the higher profile players here. Listen, if you were to ask the average soccer fan out there, I bet they could name more women's national team players than they could men's national team players. We don't need this. And I think the women have demonstrated over time they are very savvy with this social media campaign. You know, launching it on International Women's Day is very, very calculated. They know what they're doing, and they can get this done.
That's WBUR's Shira Springer, and you can read the full complaint on our website, radioboston.org. Shira, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And stick with us. There's more ahead on Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. When you think of the people who sparked change during the civil rights movement, you might think of Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks. You probably don't think of Sergeant Isaac Woodard. But a new book tells the forgotten story of how he changed the course of civil rights. It's called Unexampled Courage: The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. We spoke with the author, active federal judge Richard Gergel. He began by telling us who Sergeant Woodard was and what exactly happened on February 12th, 1946.
He was returning home to rural South Carolina after being discharged from the Army, literally on the day of his discharge, February 12, 1946. And he got into a dispute with a Greyhound bus driver about a restroom break. And the bus driver spoke to him very discourteously. And he said, "Speak to me like I'm a man. I'm a man just like you." Well, in rural South, 1946, that was not acceptable behavior for a black man, even one who wore the nation's uniform.
And who was in uniform at
the
moment.
He was in his dress uniform. And at the next stop in Batesburg, South Carolina, the bus driver went to the local police, had him removed and arrested. And while in police custody, he was beaten and blinded. And that outrageous event eventually came to the attention of President Truman, who, among other things, prompted the criminal prosecution by the federal government of the police chief, Linwood Shaw, for the blinding of Isaac Woodard. That trial was before Judge J. Wattis Waring, United States District Judge, and a jury of 12 white men acquitted the officer after 28 minutes of deliberations. that outcome so outraged and struck the conscience of the presiding judge, J. Wade Swearing, that he was forever transformed and within a matter of months began issuing landmark civil rights decisions that would eventually lead to Brown versus Board of Education. So it's these are two fascinating characters.
That's a great synopsis for us. But this is a chapter of history that's been largely forgotten. You presided in the same courthouse as Judge Waring, and you didn't know the history until you embarked on this journey.
Correct. I knew, of course, that Judge Waring had been a pioneering judge in the area of civil rights. He was in 1947. There was no one in the South like him. So a question that many journalists asked him at the era, he was a national figure. What changed you? And he would always say, while on the bench, I developed a passion for justice. Now, that was a very nice statement, but it doesn't tell us what actually changed him. And as I dug into his personal history, I focused upon this trial. And as I developed this hypothesis that it was this trial that transformed him, I learned a great deal about the blinding of Isaac Woodard, and I came to appreciate just why it would inspire him and why it would inspire Harry Truman to take bold steps in the advancement of civil rights.
Well, could you read us a little bit of your book? This is a passage on the 73rd page that sort of gets at what you're just talking about, this impact on President Truman, who up until this moment, we should say, has been sort of squishy on whether he really wants to take on civil rights as a big issue.
Right. Let me just give a little bit of background that Harry Truman, as a senator from Missouri, had a very positive civil rights record. He was considered a friend of civil rights. But as president, he had been told by his staff, as a practical matter, there was nothing he could do. And there was a great fear that he would alienate the segregationists, because the Democratic Party in the South, of course, was an all-white party at the time, and really was the branch of the party most loyal to the Democratic national ticket. So you couldn't alienate the segregationists, was the sort of party line. But on the other hand, you had this compelling moral need to address with the issues of racial justice. So this meeting on September 19 followed a series of these events involving African-American veterans returning home and suffering violence. So I read, the civil rights leaders opened the September 19 meeting by imploring Truman to take vigorous action against lynch mobs and other racially motivated violence across the South. They urged the president to call Congress into special session to adopt federal anti-lynching legislation. After listening sympathetically, Truman told them, everyone seems to believe the president by himself can do anything he wishes to on such matters as this. But the president is helpless unless he is backed by public opinion. Truman's closest ally in the room, Walter White, sensed that the president did not appreciate the gravity of the situation. Rather than continuing the discussion on proposals for presidential action, he began sharing with Truman in graphic detail the beating and blinding of Isaac Woodard. As the story unfolded, Truman sat riveted and became visibly agitated and angered. Casting his staff's advice aside, an obviously distressed president responded, my God, I had no idea it was as terrible as that. We have got to do something. Following that meeting, one day later, he writes a letter to his attorney general, and he says the time for action has now arrived. Justice Department was not prosecuting cases such as this, a white police officer victimizing an African-American citizen. And he further said, it is time for us to deal with the root causes of these problems. Well, out of that letter, which landed over the Justice Department like a bombshell, the Justice Department filed criminal charges against Linwood Shull, the police chief of Batesburg, South Carolina, for the beating and blinding of Isaac Woodard. And meanwhile, the Justice Department prepared the papers for the appointment of the Presidential Commission on Civil Rights. And out of that comes Executive Order 9981, ordering the immediate integration of the armed forces.
How much credit does Sergeant Woodard deserve for prompting that tangible action by the president?
Well, David McCullough, Harry Truman's wonderful biographer, said that the Isaac Woodard event affected Harry Truman like statistics never did. It was just something about that story of the soldier in uniform, battlefield decorated, on the day of his discharge, blinded. What an act of injustice and lack of appreciation for the service to this nation.
I found the New York Times report on this trial from 1946. This is on the acquittal, and I'll just read the lead paragraph. It's basically just a recitation of facts, but it captures so neatly what you're describing. The dateline is Columbia, South Carolina. This is November 5th of 1946. After deliberating 30 minutes, an all-white federal court jury tonight cleared Linwood L. Shull, chief of police of Batesburg, South Carolina, of a charge of violating the civil rights of Isaac Woodward of the Bronx, New York. I'll point out that Woodward is a typo in there. They didn't get the
constant,
name.
Constant, by the way, right. That permeates much of the historic record, misnaming him, including the prosecutor misnamed him in the opening charge, which outraged the NAACP lawyers who were observing the trial, that they could never even get his name straight. It was a deeply flawed prosecution.
Including not submitting medical records, for example, that might have supported Woodard's account. Because remember, the police chief in this case had claimed to have only struck Woodard one time, which didn't add up when you saw that his eyes had been put out by a billy club.
Right. The account of Isaac Woodard and the account of the police chief on how he was blinded were markedly different. Isaac Woodard said that the blackjack, the end of it was jammed into each eye. That's how you had bilateral blindness. And the police officer says, I hit him once, and if I blinded him, boy, I didn't mean that to happen. Well, they never got the medical record to discern what actually happened and the nature of his injuries. I obtained the medical record from the Veterans Administration. It wasn't easy to get, but we got it. And I gave that information to a forensic pathologist who told me there was no question that Isaac Woodard's account was correct and the account of the police chief was medically impossible. And I asked my forensic pathologist, I said, are you using techniques and knowledge that exist today but not in 1946? She says, oh, no, this was easily discernible in 1946 if someone had bothered to check it.
So the injustice of this trial has a profound impact on Judge Gergel, and I'm hoping that
Judge Waring.
Judge Waring, I'm sorry, you are Judge
Gergel. I am Judge Gergel.
Judge Gergel, could you read a little bit from your book about this? I direct you to 132nd page. This is actually the third reading in your package.
Yes,
I'm, but I'm throwing you for a loop here.
And I'm fine.
But it really gives us a sense of not only the impact on Judge Waring, but also on his wife.
Very important part of the story.
Yeah. So if you would pick us up there.
Judge Waring would later describe the Shull trial as his wife's baptism in racial prejudice and his own baptism of fire. It was a transformative event in the life of the Warings, causing them to see and sense the world around them in a fundamentally different way. The world of Jim Crow now suddenly came into focus. For the first time in his 66 years, Waitis Waring began to doubt his basic assumptions about the Southern way of life. Responding to the question of Elizabeth's friend, what are we going to do about it, the Warings began a period of serious study and reflection on the issues of race in America and a federal judge's personal responsibility to uphold the rule of law. This period of study and introspection would take Waitis Waring on a journey in which he would ultimately resolve that it was his sworn duty to boldly and forthrightly confront racial injustice, whatever the personal consequences.
And Judge Gergel, give us a sense of what a deep transformation this is for a person like Judge Waring. I mean, he's the son of a Confederate soldier. He grows up.
Now, people are surprised. They said literally the guy was an eighth generation Charlestonian. Multiple generations of his ancestors were slaveholders. He was supported for his federal appointment by Cotton Ed Smith, one of the most virulent racists in the history of the United States Senate. But this was an important period in American history. The country is at war. A war promoted on fighting racial hatred and intolerance with the Nazis. And some people, you know, would look around and say, well, you know, we're not doing that good ourselves here in the United States. So this was this very dynamic moment. And as these African-American soldiers, 900,000 strong, returned to the United States, it put the country in a great moral dilemma. And Waitis Waring was receptive to hearing it. He was different from others. I mean, he made a journey that no other federal judge had made at the time.
How should history look back, though, at figures like Judge Waring? I mean, you see sort of this mixed bag that his life was. And I think this is something that people are wrestling with a lot today. I mean, certainly in a high-profile way about Confederate statues and the like, but it may be also about our founding fathers. I mean, people who have very mixed stances over the course of their lives on race relations, but they also evolve and grow. They're imperfect. They're flawed. I mean, how do we reconcile that when we look back decades later?
First of all, we need to evaluate people in their own time, right? And Waitis Waring is a transformative figure in American history. And he personally also developed deep personal relationships with African Americans in the 50s, at a time that was highly unusual. So he went on a journey that today he would look like a pretty typical person with, you know, with real sincere relationships across racial lines. But in 1947, there was no one like Waitis Waring in the South.
Let me ask you a bit about the Briggs case now. I mean, this becomes an important precedent for Brown versus Board of Education later, 3 years later in 1954. This is a case in which Waring was in the minority. So explain his the importance of his dissent in this school segregation case in 1951.
The NAACP had been trying to find a path within a very hostile judicial climate to advance the cause of civil rights. The worst of those cases, of course, was Plessy versus Ferguson, which established the principle of separate but equal. And the NAACP decided to turn that doctrine against the segregationists because the real practice was separate and unequal. So they would bring lawsuits challenging unequal opportunities, but it was somewhat controversial because every time they used Plessy as a sword against segregationists, they were reinforcing that doctrine. And there was a thought that that doctrine was very harmful and permanently ensconced African Americans in inferior status. So Judge Waring, he felt like he was getting towards the end of his career. He thought that Plessy was legally, historically, and morally wrong. And he wanted to be part of solving this problem before he retired. And he had a case on his docket called Briggs versus Elliott from Somerton, South Carolina, a very rural, impoverished district. And Thurgood Marshall was the lawyer for the plaintiffs, and the case sought to provide equal educational opportunities in this profoundly unequal school district. And it was only a matter of trying the case for a couple of days, and the plaintiffs were going to win. Thurgood Marshall arrives at the federal courthouse in late 1950 for what is called a pretrial conference. I have him before every case. And when he arrives, Marshall is told by Judge Waring, "Bring me a frontal challenge to school segregation. Don't bring me any more separate and equal cases." Marshall says to him, because the NAACP was in the midst of a debate about how to do this, he says, "Your Honor, it's on our agenda. It's just not tonight." Pretty cool response. "This is not the case. This is not the time." Waring says, "Thurgood, it is the case. It is the time." In another part of that conversation, Marshall says, "Judge, be practical. You will be reversed by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals if you rule that segregation is unlawful." He says, "We won't go to the Fourth Circuit because I'm going to arrange for the convening of a three-judge panel, because if you challenge school segregation, it requires a three-judge panel as a challenge to a state law, constitutionality of a state law." Marshall said, "Well, Judge, we'll lose 2-1. He says, "Exactly, but you then automatically go into the docket of the U.S. Supreme Court." And he says, "Thurgood, that's where you want to be." Marshall leaves the room shocked, as I'm sure any lawyer would be that a judge would so directly direct him how to act. And they then go into the very public pretrial conference, which is being covered by reporters. And Waring says, "Mr. Marshall, are you prepared to confront school segregation?" He says, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "I'm going to allow you to dismiss this lawsuit and refile it." He did. And out of that came the first frontal challenge to public school segregation in American history. It would eventually be one of the five cases that make up Brown versus Board of Education. And it was the first case tried, the first case filed. Waitis Waring dissented in that case. And he fashioned a theory about how why the separate and equal doctrine made no sense, because all segregation was per se inequality and per se unconstitutional. That language then is used 3 years later in the greatest case in American history, Brown versus Board of Education.
And it's within that dissent in 1951 that Judge Waring praises the plaintiffs for their unexampled courage. And
right.
That's where that phrase comes from.
The plaintiffs are targeted for retaliation. The level of their courage is just extraordinary.
And it's a phrase that could certainly be applied to Sergeant Isaac Woodard. So
Sergeant Woodard, Harry Truman, Judge Waring, Thurgood Marshall. I mean, this is a story of unexampled courage.
In the moments we have left, could you describe what else we know about the rest of Sergeant Woodard's life? I mean, he's blinded now at a young age, at 26, and how does he live out the rest of his days?
Well, his wife quickly let him know she was not interested in maintaining a relationship with a blinded husband. So he went to the home of his parents in the Bronx, and He lived in obscurity. I mean, nobody remembered who he was. He was very famous in 1946. This was a well-known story. But he soon faded into obscurity. And the tragic part of this is he never knew his impact on Harry Truman or Judge Waring or his impact on American history.
Judge Griegel, before I let you go, I have to ask you about the impact of this research and perhaps the example of Judge Waring on your own work. I mean, you're probably best known to our listeners and the public for presiding over the Dylann Roof trial. Dylann Roof, of course, being the white supremacist who killed the Charleston Nine at that church in South Carolina. I mean, what examples can you draw from perhaps Judge Waring or other things that you've taken in your work and applied in your own work today on the bench?
Well, Cal, I'm sure you understand I don't comment about any of my cases. But let me just say generally that Judge Waring is an inspiration to all judges. One of my most popular audiences involve judges, and they find great inspiration in it because it just tells us that our duty is to uphold the rule of law, to uphold the ideals of the United States Constitution. It's a sacred duty, and Judge Waring is just an extraordinary example of and a model for all of us.
That's Judge Richard Griegel. He's a U.S. District Court judge in South Carolina and the author of Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard, and The Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. Judge Griegel, thank you so much for your
time. Pleasure to be here.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.